You're listening to 88.1 FM KPPPLP Fargo Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. Hey, everybody. Thank you for being here. Let's get right to it. I have a lot of information for you today. I told you last time on my show, Immigration Part 3, that I was going to be shifting to talking about the history of sexual deviancy or proclivities in immigration history. But I have something even better for you for tonight's show instead, which is an interview that I did with the co-founder and co-director of CIVIC, the Community Initiative for Visiting Migrants Group, Christina Mansfield. And that will be shared with you today on this show. So, this is A Mexican Crossing Lines with your hosts, Cindy Gomez-Shemp
and Duke Gomez-Shemp.
You're listening to 88.1 FM KPPPLP Fargo Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. And I want to thank you all for sending me all of the information that you have been on this topic and on others. I'm going to be bringing you exciting investigations into other areas very soon, but I've been sticking with this topic of immigration because there's a lot of policies and stories that are coming out around not just the detention centers, mass incarceration in general, the abuses that people suffer within those isolated places like jails and prisons and detention centers, where a majority of Americans have never been, have never had someone inside, have never had contact with the people that are in there right now, and don't know how those places actually operate. We're focusing on immigration as well, because there has been a concerted effort, especially recently, to confuse people about what is happening with immigration policy. And I will talk more about that in my interview with Christina Mansfield, but I wanted to share with you some of the information in the articles that we're going to talk about in that interview beforehand, so you know what we were discussing. And how can folks send us information, Duke?
A lot of different ways. One way is there's a call-in number right on your screen. It's a call-in number. It's a message line. It's 701-566-0917. Again, it's a message line. You can leave a message up to 3 minutes. It's something where you can give an opinion, give us some advice, or just get in contact with us. And sometimes people give commentary that we actually use on the air. So that's a good way to do it. Another way that's really effective is just email cindy@kppfm.com and duke@kppfm.com. And you can also go to Facebook. A lot of people do a lot of Facebook messaging through Messenger. Our Facebook site is 88.1. FM Fargo Moorhead. We also have the People's Press Project and Mexi-Can. And we also have a website, kpppfm.com. It's where we put all of our podcasts. And the podcasts go in audio format and video format. You can comment on each one, kpppfm.com. You can just go to podcasts and those all of our latest shows. And also on that site, you can find out more about us. It's an About Us. There's also a contact button. And there's also a donate button. We're a nonprofit, commercial-free radio station. And we rely on contributions from the community to keep on going. And we don't do commercials. We do what's called underwriting. You can check that out on our webpage, too, at kpppfm.com, where your business can make a contribution and we'll mention you on the air, kind of similar to what PBS does, you know, for that underwriting. And you get a tax-deductible contribution.
Uh-huh. And guess what? We have some exciting news.
Oh, yeah, some awesome news, yeah.
Awesome news, mm-hmm. Even better. Why don't you share our awesome news, Duke?
Well, if you look at the screen, we got a $1,000 grant from the awesome foundation of Cass and Clay County.
Yay!
And they're a local foundation, but they're connected to a national network of called the Awesome Foundation. Just look them up on the web. You might have one in your community where people get together and they raise money and they give $1,000 away every month for an awesome idea. So we wrote a project where we combined the work of Nemo and Finding Me, as well as needing equipment to get more people involved in the station, and they gave us a $1,000 check the other day.
Yes, and we were so, I mean, I'm proud of Nemo's work with Finding Me because I think that it is so essential for people to understand at this time in our history the struggles that queer people and transgender people are still facing every day. And in addition to that, our mission here of giving voice to people that are marginalized and having the space to give them the training and give them access to equipment, it's always been part of what we do here at 88.1 FM. And so anytime that any organizations or local businesses or people in the community or our listeners and viewers send us a donation to support this work, it makes us super happy. We're thrilled.
Definitely.
We want to thank the awesome people over at the Awesome Foundation for funding us. And you can go check out their work on our website. I have a link to, on our Facebook page, excuse me, I have a link to this award, and you can go like their page and check out the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to share with you some of the articles, or I have already put them into the links in the comment section of this show. They will be available on our website at kpppfm.com along with this program, so you can go find out more about the civic organization itself, which incidentally is going to be changing its name very soon. One of the reasons for this is that the organization CIVIC, which again stands for Community Initiative for Visiting Migrants, which has been around for a while, is now being confused with CCA, Correctional Corporations of America. Now, CCA and GEO Group are the two largest private company owners of prisons and detention centers in the country. And CCA, who I mentioned in my interview with Christina Mansfield, has changed its name in the past, has again changed its name to CIVIC. So I actually questioned Christina about what were her thoughts. Was this done on purpose to try to confuse people? Or was it merely an accident, you know, that they just happened to decide they wanted to change their name to CIVIC, a well-known organization that tries to help get people out of detention and wants to end detention. So they're going to be changing their name to Freedom for Immigrants, and you'll be able to find them at freedomforimmigrants.org. For now, they're located at www.endisolation.org. We will have resources from their page, including a map of all of the different detention centers, statistics on those detention centers, how you can locate people. They've got multilingual, bilingual information available. They have a hotline you can call if you want to report abuses in detention centers against immigrants, or if you want to find an immigrant, if you want information about the work that they do, if you want to start a visitation programs to go and visit undocumented people in your hometown, you can call CIVIC National Immigration Detention Hotline. All of this information is available on their website. But we're also going to be discussing, I also wanted to share some of the latest information that is related to this in the news. The first one is one story of a corrupt sheriff in Alabama who, in Etowah County, Etowah Sheriff, who pocketed $750,000 in money that was allocated to buy food for inmates. Okay. And as you will hear during my show, Christina Mansfield's volunteer program that goes and visits people in detention has a volunteer program in this county. And the people that were going to visit inmates in this in these jails in this area were reporting that the inmates said they were starving. People were starving inside. And here is a good reason why that starvation was happening. Because this Etowah sheriff decided he would pocket $750,000 and he bought a beach house with all but $10,000 of that money.
Yep.
So he used $750,000 to buy himself a beach house. And you may be wondering if he's going to jail soon. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is no, because what he did is legal.
Yep.
It's totally legal for the sheriff to take that money and buy himself a beach house with it. Meanwhile, the people in the jail can starve. The people are literally forced to buy their own food and or eat substandard food. Many times, as we've talked about, people get food that is either poisoned or has maggots. And if you actually go to the article that was written in this Birmingham paper, they go through a lot of this sheriff's other corrupt practices, apparently all of which are legal. And he's been getting away with taking these kickbacks and assigning contracts to the people that pay for his campaign and these fundraisers. Oh, my God. It's crazy. Go read about what this guy is doing and don't think for a minute that he is a bad apple. If this is happening and it's legal there, it's legal other places, and this kind of practice is taking place everywhere. It's taking place here in the Fargo-Moorhead region. Do you remember when we talked about stories that were published here in the local media about people reporting that they Muslims that were being forced to eat pork?
Yes, yes.
People that were being starved,
mm-hmm.
People that were losing 20 and 30 pounds inside that were reporting that they were being given either substandard food or that they were being starved?
Yes, yes. And one reason is that these the committees that govern the sheriffs, which is usually county commission, those are entities that have very little public input. People get elected, they're on a ballot, and then they run the counties. And that's why across the country, the county commission meetings aren't well attended. People aren't that involved, and they just write their own rules. So this isn't the only instance of where a local city or a local county will do things just for themselves. You know, and like Cindy said, that in this specific county, not illegal for the sheriff to take that money, use it for his own use because their policies say they can. That's because people don't get involved in their own public policy arenas and public commissions that govern these areas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it says right here in the article, many Alabama sheriffs contend that the practice of keeping excess inmate feeding funds, and they get to decide what the excess is. He used only $10,000 for something else of the money that was allocated. He took $750,000 and used $740,000 of that for his beach house.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more important than buying food and food trays for the inmates. And it says here that this is something that many of those sheriffs in that state believe is inmate is legal under a state law that was passed before World War II. Yet in a number of counties, including Jefferson and Montgomery, any money allocated to sheriff for feeding inmates that is not used for that purpose is instead turned over to the county government. So some people do have to turn that money over, but not in this particular place. And according to this, there was a report filed in the Alabama Ethics Commission that this sheriff made more than $250,000 on each of the past 3 years via the inmate feeding fund.
Wow.
So this is not his first time doing it. Each of the past 3 years, he has taken $250,000 from the feeding fund for his own pocket.
Mm-hmm.
To pay himself. His annual sheriff salary is supposed to be $93,000. That's really different from $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, this is not his only extra property besides his original property. He has a variety of property. Many people in where he lives were wondering how this guy who's only supposed to be making less than $100,000 a year can have all of these different houses. He got a mortgage for $592,000 from People's Bank of Alabama, according to the public real estate records. The home, the beach house that he bought, is one of several properties with a total assessed value of over $1.7 million that he and his wife own together. Sounds like he is making a tidy sum of cash by not feeding inmates.
Oh, yeah.
These are the kinds of abuses that, again, are completely legal and that are probably happening everywhere in America. Let me move on to the next story here. The next one that I think is really important for you to pay attention to, as we're seeing all of this talk of immigration raids and sanctuary cities, is this story about how there's going to be a ban that is going to start in Texas on all sanctuary cities. Now, according to this article in the New York Times, a federal appeals court ruled on Tuesday that the Texas ban on sanctuary cities could go into effect. And this is very disturbing given the fact that there have been conflicting legal opinions as to whether or not sanctuary cities or banning sanctuary cities is unconstitutional. If banning funding to places that are sanctuary cities is something enforceable, if criminalizing or threatening to arrest and or criminalize city leaders that allow sanctuary cities is legal or even enforceable. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't stopped Jeff Sessions, for example, from making threats against states for doing just that, for having sanctuary cities. Personally, I've talked to people that are absolutely unequivocally sure that there's no way that this is going to fly. Like, you can have a sanctuary city and the federal government in no way, shape, or form can force local police departments to enforce federal law. Mm-hmm. They're not immigration. They're not ICE. They're not DHS, Department of Homeland Security. They cannot force local law enforcement officers to do their job, which they're not paying local law enforcement to do. Mm-hmm. They cannot make that an unfunded mandate, which, by the way, does not make our communities safer. It makes our communities more unsafe because undocumented people can be the witnesses of crimes as well as the victims of crimes. But if they're forced to hide in the shadows, then they can't come forward. What that has led to is horrible miscarriages of justice, like what we saw in Maricopa County, mm-hmm. where Sheriff Joe Arpaio left hundreds of sexual assault cases against children uninvestigated because he decided instead he would profile people, violate their human rights and their constitutional rights, and focus on those undocumented people rather than do his job as a sheriff. And unfortunately, that is what has happened across the country. There's already plenty of evidence that if people cannot report crimes to the police, those communities are more unsafe. Crime runs rampant in places where there are people that have to stay underground and hide. And this ruling is very disconcerting because there was a previous decision that basically said the opposite of this ruling, which is that they could not ban people from having sanctuary cities. So the fact that this unanimous 3-judge ruling and the Fifth Circuit, which reversed the ruling from August, is bonkers, backwards, mm-hmm. completely the opposite, shows you just how polarized the conversation is. On the one hand, Senate Bill 4, which passed in the Texas legislature in May 2017, said that police officials and sheriffs had to cooperate, were required to cooperate with federal immigration officials and allowing police to question immigration status of anyone. Mm. This was passed in response to a bunch of different cities in Texas declaring themselves sanctuary cities.
Yep.
So it was retaliation.
Definitely.
This is my opinion. I feel that what the people that chose to create those sanctuaries did was to protect their communities, mm-hmm. to try to make sure that there is not an unfunded mandate on their police department that is going to make their police department spend more time on doing federal enforcement of immigration policy than on handling local crime, and is going to put a bunch of people in the shadows where they cannot report crime, which makes them more vulnerable to crime, domestic abuse, right?
Yep.
So they decided, we're going to protect our communities from this. We're going to make sure that a bunch of our community members and businesses aren't shut down by immigration raids, and that those people and money resources that are going into the coffers of your city's local tax base. Because yes, undocumented immigrants pay taxes. They do so every time they purchase something. They do so when they work. They're paying money into your community, into the infrastructure of your community. And what happens is the federal government can come in with ICE, round up a bunch of people like they did in Postville, Iowa, and destroy the economy of that town, and take those dollars and put them into a GO group or CCA, now called Civic, owned private detention center, and line the pockets of the CEOs of those companies. That money is being taken out of your communities. And Texas, California, those states have a lot of brown and black people. Mm-hmm. Those states have a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars, that are directly transferable from the bodies and the resources of undocumented immigrants into the hands of these private corporations. So to me, seeing this kind of hostile response by the state legislature, by the way, in many of these states, it was the governors of the states, like in Arizona, Jan Brewer, mm-hmm. and ALEC, this legislative group that created a lot of these racist immigration policies and instituted these private prisons in many states. They have an incentive. Many of them are invested directly in the private prison corporation system. So they're doing this in response to them not benefiting financially directly from all the money to be made by rounding up all the new slaves to be put into these detention centers. And the question around America is going to be, not just in Texas and in California, are you going to let your state do that? Are you going to let the powerful, money-hungry politicians in the state legislatures that are in cahoots with the people that are going to be profiting off of these expanded prisons and jails in your town and these detention centers, are you going to let them take the people resources, undocumented people, and their money and that tax money that they pay in out of your communities and put it in the hands of CCA and GO? Are you going to keep and demand that those people keep that money and those resources in your community? That's the question you need to start asking yourselves right now. I believe that this is a dog whistle to other states to scare them into having these discussions end about sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. Because rather than come up with a policy that is sensibly going to protect our communities and make sure that our money isn't being ripped out of our communities and put into the hands of these private corporations and these government leaders, what we need to do is demand that our police departments do not get involved in enforcing immigration policy. We have to demand that our city leaders create a sanctuary in mm-hmm. every town in America, because this is what is coming for you exactly. if you don't.
And in Minnesota, I mean, Minneapolis is a sanctuary city. They passed a city ordinance. And then the state legislature tried to undo it mm-hmm. because they felt that the city was thumbing its nose at the federal government. And people had to educate all these legislators that now exactly the points you were talking about, that it makes the police ineffective in their work when you have unfunded mandates for them to do things. And so in Minneapolis, it didn't get taken away, but then During the same time, other cities in Minnesota were being raided by ICE, and the police were helping because mm-hmm. they're not sanctuary cities. So it is important to have across the board sanctuary state, you know,
yeah,
to really protect people and their human rights.
And you can demand that. And this conversation about thumbing your nose and not following the law, remember, everyone, especially if you're watching my show, you know that's hogwash. This is not about protecting, securing our criminals. No. This is about money. This has always been about money and who is going to make the money. Let me show you. Moving on to the next article here. Let's look at this ICE spokesperson who quit. Did you hear about this story? We're going to talk about all of these things. I will mention them during my interview with Christina Mansfield. So I didn't go into the details of these articles mm-hmm. during the interview. So I want you to know in advance what you're going to be hearing about so you can have a point of reference to opine from. This story just came out recently about Linda Valadez stating that ICE spokesperson James Schwab refused to repeat inaccurate information about a recent immigration raid, and he quit because of it. Hmm. And there was this whole, hullabaloo around this immigration raid because the mayor of the town decided she would announce to everyone before the immigration raid occurred that it was coming so people could protect themselves, which I think is hella cool.
Yeah.
I think that the mayor did something awesome. I think that it would have been inhumane. I realize that this means other mayors in other towns are privy to ICE raids and don't say anything and allow them to happen. And those people are evil yeah. and disgusting. I think that this mayor is amazing. Mayor Libby Schaaf in Oakland, California, decided to notify everyone that the ICE raid was coming because she did not feel that what was going to be done to those people was right. And guess what? They were going to target 1,000 people, and they only were able to arrest 200 and some of those people. So 864 residents were spared the immigration's wrath. And this set off this firestorm against the mayor. So everyone's, of course, in Trump's administration was attacking her. Trump himself, I think, tweeted or said that she was something. I don't know if it was despicable or terrible or I can't remember. But he said something disparaging about the mayor. And then Jeff Sessions doubled down on that and said that, yeah, this mayor is responsible for 800 and some criminals, dangerous criminals, to be free. They're on the lam or something. They said it in this way that it made it sound like these people, at large, excuse me.
Okay.
Those are 800 wanted aliens that are now at large in that community, said Jeff Sessions. Most are wanted criminals that ICE will now have to pursue with more difficulty and more dangerous situations, all because of one mayor's irresponsible action. Well, the spokesperson for ICE felt that that statement was irresponsible because it's inaccurate. In the majority of raids that ICE undertakes, they are unable to recover people. So they recover about a third of the people that they intend to try to grab. So saying that it's the mayor's fault that they weren't able to get these people is false, inaccurate. Saying that the people are dangerous is inaccurate because the spokesperson said only 5 of the 800 and some people would have been considered criminals. And the characterization of all of these undocumented people that are out there still free as dangerous or scary or alien or criminal is dehumanizing to migrants. They're humans. So all of this nonsense got to the conscience of this ICE person, and it melted his ICE heart, and he quit his job.
Yeah.
The mayor of the town praised him for having the, you know, intestinal fortitude to quit his job and stand up to this nonsense. Mm-hmm. However, he's not that nice of a guy. Before you go patting him on the back too hard for quitting his job.
He worked for ICE, so.
Yeah, I mean, the monster was working for ICE. But not only that, also, he thought that the mayor did the wrong thing by alerting the people in the public about the ICE raid. Mm-hmm. He thought she could have done something else. I think he called what she did, I don't know, something not as harsh as what the president said, but it wasn't nice. He said something more about, you know, like she thought she could have done things differently.
Yeah.
But he really, what he really objected to was that the president and Sessions characterized the mayor as being the irresponsible fall guy. Mm-hmm. So in truth, this guy was just, he doesn't really care about the humanity of the immigrants. He was more concerned that he not step on the toes of this mayor you know, wrong her in that way. He don't care about wronging immigrants. He can do that all day, every day.
Yep.
But let me be real clear on what this is really about. And you'll hear Christina talk about this throughout our interview. This is about the money.
Yep.
That's all this has ever been about. So, without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and have you start this interview with Christina Mansfield. I hope that you guys enjoy the information. There's a lot of information on how you can get involved with the work that she's doing. But there's also a lot of information in here that probably will reinforce some of the things you've heard me say about the oversight on this system, about the corruption, and, you know, different strategies for people in their hometowns to try to combat against this. So please share this out, and thank you for listening.
Yep.
Load her up.
Get it loaded up. It takes about 15, 20 seconds for this interview to go on, so cool. Just going to have to stall a little bit
until it pops up. Give us a second here.
A little bit longer.
Can't wait to see all your comments on this interview and your questions. I will definitely have her on again. This is A Mexican Crossing Lines with your hosts, Cindy Gomez-Shemp and Duke Gomez-Shemp. You're listening to 88.1 FM KPPPLP Fargo-Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. Today, I have a very special guest from the organization Civic, Community Initiative for Visiting Migrants. She is the co-director, executive director of Civic, along with her colleague, Christina Fialho. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And this organization has recently received the James Irvin Foundation Leadership Award in 2018. Congratulations on the award, and thank you for being with us on the show today, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to talk about what you've been doing out in California with this program. Would you like to describe the mission of the work?
Sure, sure. Civic stands for Community Initiatives for Visiting Immigrants in Confinement. We are actually in the process of changing our name. So as of next week, we're going to be known as Freedom for Immigrants. So just so folks can continue to follow us. Mm-hmm. So we are a national network of over 43 community organizations across the country that are visiting people who are in U.S. immigration detention and who are providing support through that visitation. And basically what we do visitation is our window into what's happening to people in these detention facilities, and we're able to monitor detention facility conditions, lift up the stories of people who are detained and their families, and really, you know, educate the public about the cost of the system and the suffering that it causes.
And why is that necessary? I mean, having people talking about what's happening inside a detention center, why would that be important?
Yeah, well, you know, I think under this administration, there's a lot more awareness of our immigration detention system. But even still, there's lots of folks who don't even know that on any given day, we're detaining over 40,000 people in immigration detention facilities across the country. And the reason that we're doing that is because it is profitable to do so. And I can kind of explain more about that.
And, you know, I want to direct people to go to your website and look at the wealth of resources that are available for people to educate themselves more about this. Mm-hmm. We'll be sharing that along with this program. And the different links to different resources, like the maps and statistics page that allows people to find out where all the detention centers are, and also the national hotline information. You run a national hotline that allows people to get information about their loved ones in detention, or to report issues with people that are in detention, as well as information about your visitation program, because you want to expand this nationwide, correct?
Absolutely. Our goal is, well, our ultimate goal is to end this immigration detention system. And, you know, there are basically community run alternatives to immigration detention. And a lot of the folks who are part of our network are doing work like that. And these solutions are far more cost effective, far more humane. So that is what we're advocating for in the long term. But in the meantime, we want to make sure that every single detention facility in the United States has some kind of community presence, so that no one is being forgotten or neglected or abused in these facilities.
One thing I really want our listeners to understand is that there's very little, if any, oversight of these detention centers and any kind of, you know, misconduct that goes on inside. And people really believe that if ICE is rounding you up, you must have committed some kind of a crime. And they also believe that if the detention centers are being run by our government in the United States, there isn't any there is no misconduct. People are being treated well inside. Can you speak to those two points?
Absolutely. Yes. So in terms of the point about the rhetoric around crime, or the assumption that people in immigration detention must have committed some crime, that's absolutely not the case. Basically, you know, being out of status, or, you know, basically that is immigration violations are civil violations of the law. They are not criminal violations of the law. Mm-hmm. And in this administration, we're definitely seeing some moves to kind of move it towards a criminal violation, but at this point it's not. And so what that means is that folks who are in the system, there's basically like three main groups of the kinds of people who are in this system. Number one are asylum seekers who are fleeing this country, fleeing their home countries to come to the United States and seek refuge from persecution. Those people, due to laws that we passed in 1996, are mandatorily detained in immigration detention. So they follow the law, and they come to our border and they say, I am seeking asylum. That's the legal process. But our response to them following the law and that legal process is to immediately incarcerate them in what's called immigration detention, but what is, for all intents and purposes, a prison. And folks who pass what's called a credible fear interview in their asylum process may be eligible for release, but that's going to take some time, and it's actually going to cost them money that in most cases they don't have. Then there's folks who are in the United States and who have overstayed visas or are simply out of status. And those folks, you know, have not committed any crimes. And then there are folks who are lawful permanent residents who may have had interactions with the criminal justice system that lead to their detention, or folks that may have been convicted for a crime, but people who have served time for that crime and the criminal justice system has decided that they're fit to go back into society, and then our immigration laws and our immigration detention system are doubly punishing them. So this is, you know, the rhetoric around crime and criminals is a huge, huge, huge misconception about this system. And then with
go ahead.
Well, with regards to your asking about, you know, the assumption that people think that these are government run facilities. So there are only, I believe, three facilities that are actually run by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The rest of the facilities around the country, and there are 211 detention facilities around the country, and these facilities, basically our government is contracting with either private prison corporations who hold, you know, imprison people in detention and run the facilities, or our government is contracting with county jail facilities, and people are detained along with county jail inmates in county jails across the U.S., and those facilities are run by the sheriff's deputies, basically. So in very few facilities does the government really have any presence? And even before the Trump administration, we have something called the performance-based national detention standards. And those are standards that outline how people in detention should be treated. And the last time that they were updated was 2016. But these are not codified in law. So there is no way to enforce violations of these standards that are ICE's own standards in immigration detention. And basically what we've seen since Trump was elected was pretty much an abandonment of trying to follow these standards at all.
And there are violations and misconduct that are taking place that are putting people inside of these detention centers at risk. Can you give us some examples of the things that you have heard people report or that your visitation groups have found out?
Absolutely. There are all kinds of examples, unfortunately. The most common complaints that we hear of are complaints around medical neglect. And last year, Civic authored a report with Human Rights Watch called Systemic Indifference, Dangerous and Substandard Medical Care in Immigration Detention. Mm-hmm. And in that report, we basically reviewed the records of the medical records of folks that we had, supported and worked with who had experienced medical neglect, and doctors review those records and determine that in many cases, what happened to these people was the fault of the facility staff. And then sexual assault is another huge, huge problem in immigration detention. We did a civil rights complaint in April of 2017, calling for a federal investigation into reports of sexual abuse, assault, and harassment in immigration detention. And as part of this report, we analyzed data that we got through a Freedom of Information Act request, which found that less than 1% of more than 33,000 complaints of sexual and physical abuse were investigated. So 33,000 complaints, less than 1% were ever investigated.
And, you know, the number that you talked about, 30,000 some people detained per day, that's a huge increase from, say, the 70s and 80s. There's been a build out of these detention centers in mass, and the numbers that we would see, like in the 70s and 80s, might be around 30 people detained per day. Can you talk a little bit about what accounts for this huge number that we're seeing and how it's become so normalized that today massive roundups of people are just kind of par for the course?
Yeah, absolutely. So really the history of this system is pretty fascinating. Like you said, back in the 1980s, we were detaining less than 30 people in the entire country per day. And what changed is that in 1983 and 1984, two of the largest private prison companies in the country, one called Correction and Corporation of America, which recently changed its name to Core Civic, was founded in 1983, and the other huge giant private prison corporation is called Geo Group, and that was formed in 1984. So actually, CCA's, Geo's first contract was for an immigration detention facility, and CCA Core Civic's the second facility they opened was the first immigration detention facility to detain infants and children. So what we're seeing in this history is that the rise of our immigration detention system wasn't predicated on any kind of need or necessity. It was predicated on the power of these corporations and the support of our government in helping them to make a profit.
So this is about money, and there is money to be made off of keeping people in detention. One distinction I wanted to make is that in the past, people self-deported, and the number of days that people ended up in a detention center was usually very limited, if at all, because many people would choose to self-deport and go right back across the border and then try to re-enter the country again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're seeing people being held in detention on average 6 months to a year. And I believe that that has to do with the profit incentive. How do you believe that this Supreme Court decision that was recently made about keeping people in detention indefinitely will affect the numbers of detainees?
Yeah, that's a very unfortunate decision recently. So basically, that decision says that that people who are in mandatory immigration detention are, and what that means is that people are, certain classes of people are in immigration detention and they don't have the right to see a judge and to ask for discretion. So, and the people who are in mandatory immigration detention generally are actually lawful permanent residents who, as I said before, have had some contact with the criminal justice system or have served time for some kind of conviction that is now over. So in these scenarios, these are folks who have such long-standing ties to this country, and oftentimes they have really strong legal cases.
So are you,
these are the folks.
Are you telling me, are you saying, just to be clear here, that lawful permanent residents, people that have deeper connections, deeper ties to the United States, actually get treated worse within the system?
Yes, in the sense that they have less rights to request discretion and release. That's absolutely true.
That is insane. I wanted to also ask you, because you're out in California, and you mentioned that things have been kind of crazy for you, crazy busy, I mean, but also Jeff Sessions just sued California. What kind of impact is this having, not just in California and on your work specifically, but how will this kind of lawsuit impact other states?
Yeah, so it's not clear to me yet how this is going to impact other states. Basically, there was a lot of really amazing legislation that was passed in the state of California last year that was in direct response to the Trump administration's agenda of targeting and criminalizing immigrant communities. And Jeff Sessions just announced that he is suing over three of those laws, one of which Civic, my organization, helped to draft, which basically is a budget measure that puts a moratorium on the expansion of immigration detention in the state of California. So basically, any of the county jail facilities, of which I believe there are about nine in the state of California, those facilities cannot expand their contract to detain more people in the state. And that's really important because this is a federal system. And the only way to get rid of this system is to do it, you know, at the federal level, because if we're just shutting down individual facilities in any state, or in California, that just means that the government is going to open a facility elsewhere and they're going to detain the same number of people no matter what. So we really have to be careful at how we try to dismantle this system. But in terms of the lawsuit, you know, it's really devastating, and we're not really sure what impact it's going to have yet. We have yet to see if there's going to be a preliminary injunction issued, in which case the implementation of all three laws that he's challenging would be put on hold, and this would be a process that, you know, is very much stuck in the courts for a number of years.
Sort of like DACA.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they're dismantling the system, or the way that you're trying to go about dismantling the system, is critical because nobody really has talked about dismantling it versus maintaining it. I mean, even some of the people in Congress that have been more friendly on this issue, like Kamala Harris, have said that there is a need to maintain ICE. Can you speak to your strong mission and vision of actually dismantling and ending this practice of detention and deportation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this entire system, like I said, in the 1980s, we detained less than 30 people a year. This system has exploded because it is profitable and because our government has supported these private prison corporations in making that profit from our taxpayer dollars. So, you know, in our view, this system is entirely unnecessary. Basically, the immigration detention system is predicated on the idea that if you don't lock people up in prisons for years, for what is a civil violation of the law, and this because it's civil, it's not supposed to be a punishment. But these facilities are extremely punitive, and in reality, it is a form of punishment. So, you know, the whole system is predicated on this idea that if you don't imprison people, they might not show up to their court hearings. And we believe this to be an entirely false premise. And there are pilot programs that have been done that, rather than detain people in immigration detention, they are programs that are facilitated by community organizations who are providing support to people who would otherwise be detained. And through that support, through that kind of case management, they're able to, you know, the folks are complying with everything they have to comply with, and they're showing up to their court hearings, and they want to stay here. So this is like the fundamental premise of the system that's just entirely false. But moreover, you know, there's these alternatives to immigration detention. They cost a fraction of what it costs to imprison a person on any given day. And so we can choose and we can demand from our representatives that our taxpayer dollars be spent in this more cost-effective and far more humane way, rather than being spent on immigration detention. And really what we're trying to show through our work is that not only is it a waste of taxpayer dollars, But actually what's happening in the system is our taxpayer dollars are funding and perpetuating massive human rights violations.
And there was a moment last year, I think it was last year, when there was an expose in Mother Jones. I don't know if you remember seeing it by Shane Bauer. I covered it here.
Absolutely.
I covered it here on our radio station because I thought this was the nail in the coffin. I thought, okay, this is going to, everybody's going to see the rampant abuses in these private prisons and they're going to shut them down. And not too long after that, the federal government announced, the Department of Justice said they would no longer be contracting with these private detention centers. The majority of the private prisons are detention centers. And they said they were not going to do this. I think they had to end their contracts, or they weren't going to renew the contracts when they ended, I guess. But to me, it feels like now those reports and all of those abuses that the government said they were going to end their contracts with these detention facilities, that that's kind of being retracted or ignored or made invisible. What do you suppose happened? It doesn't seem to me, I don't know what your impression is, that the government really intends to decrease its work with these detention centers, these private detention centers. But in fact, I feel they're going to increase the number of people that they're putting in detention.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it is a very confusing sequence of events that happened. But you're right. Basically, before Trump was elected to office, we were on the verge of really being able to change the tide of, you know, the public's opinion and even the government's opinion of whether contracting with private prison corporations is a good idea. Basically, the Department of Justice, like you said, announced that it wasn't going to contract with private prisons anymore. And this actually, they were not talking about any immigration detention facilities at that time, but it made a huge impact on, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security, because more than 60% of people in immigration detention are in the same private facilities, and not the same as in the same physical facilities, but the same type of facilities run by the same corporation.
Right.
So basically ICE formed a committee to investigate whether they were going to continue contracting with private prisons. Uh-huh. And they produced an initial report that said, like, oh, you know, we're just going to continue to contract with private prisons. And then as this report was presented to the committee, there was kind of an insurrection, and basically the committee members refused to kind of ratify that decision. So there's, you know, you can see this internal strife about whether this is a good idea or not. And it was really, really, it made a big impact on our work, because at that time we had put forward a bill in the state of California called the Dignity Not Detention Act. And basically what that bill does is it limits the ability of private prison corporations to expand for immigration detention purposes in the state of California. Mm-hmm. So at that time, the bill was on Governor Brown's desk. That's our California governor. And he actually chose to veto the bill because he said, oh, look, ICE is actually looking into this themselves. So he just kind of punted it because it seemed like something might be done. But of course, then nothing was done. But to his credit, Governor Jerry Brown this year signed the Dignity Not Detention Act that we put forward again. And that is now law. And, you know, clearly in the face of this administration, it was obvious to Governor Brown and to the legislature that this was a really needed reform.
And it feels to me like there's like this recognition in moments like that expose in Mother Jones that showed us what many of us had already heard echoed decades ago about detention centers and the way that people are treated by immigration, by ICE, by Homeland Security, by Border Patrol, the kinds of misconduct and abuses that go on. You're listening to 88.1 FM, KPPPLP Fargo-Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. And every time it feels like the reality of what happens to people in detention that are undocumented and exploited, there is a backlash to that. And it feels it feels like that's happening with the discussion about secure communities. I mean, with the discussion about sanctuary cities and the participation of different police departments with secure communities, or 287G, as it's also known. Could you speak to that back and forth? And, you know, California kind of leads the way on this. You guys have sanctuary cities. There's been threats to politicians and to, you know, city coffers by the federal government if this sanctuary city status persists, not only in California, but in other places. Would you speak to that kind of fear-mongering that's going on, and where do you think it's going to shake out?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, this has been a long-standing source of conflict, not only at the not only in the state of California and other states and localities that are trying to defend their position as sanctuary cities or states, or but also this was a conflict within the agency itself, within Immigration and Customs Enforcement. There was a lot of uncertainty about what really the Secure Communities Program meant, and how. To what extent did localities have to comply with it, and to what extent was it voluntary? So this has been going on for such a long time. SB 54, which is the California Values Act, this was passed and signed into law this legislative session, I mean the last legislative session, along with the Dignity Not Detention Act. And this bill ensures that no state or local resources are diverted to fuel any attempts by the federal government to carry out mass deportations. And so this is one of the measures that's being challenged by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And so it's, you know, it's in question whether California is going to be stifled in its ability to try to protect our immigrant communities. But I guess I'll just say that it's been, you know, it's kind of this like long-standing sort of federal versus states' rights battle. And I think it's really interesting. We've seen this at other points in history. We saw this at the end of slavery in the United States. There was a lot of attempts by states to try to protect their citizens from slavery, and then, you know, challenges by the federal government to that. So we definitely have historical precedent for this kind of conflict.
And what would you say to the average person who just doesn't understand the back and forth? I mean, I think last year it was pretty well settled, and maybe even going into the year prior to that, that secure communities was a disaster, and that they people weren't going to be forced to participate. And even the program itself was kind of shut down, if I recall correctly. And now, and also the proliferation of secure of sanctuary cities became a thing. People were talking about it. People were looking at other cities and saying, how do we bring that to our community to make our community safer? Now the pendulum seems to be swinging back the other way, and we have all of these threats. Texas just an appellate court just upheld the right of Texas to begin a ban on sanctuary cities. Where does the average person that wants to protect undocumented people, how do they make a decision, whether they're a politician that, that's on city council, or they're just somebody that wants to see the people in their community have a place to be safe? What kind of recommendation would you make to those folks looking at this battle?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing to remember is that we the people have the power to determine the laws of this country, and we the people need to hold our representatives accountable for what we want to see. Basically, this sanctuary cities conflict is really about to what extent can the federal government force local police departments and different local institutions to basically do them a favor and hold someone who may be out of their immigration status, out of status, and basically hold them so that ICE can come and take them off the immigration detention. And there is no requirement that any locality should do that, is the argument that I believe in.
And it is an unfunded mandate for police departments to be taking on the job of the federal government in doing immigration law. But I believe that many local police and, you know, on a national level, you can go to your local police department, you can go to your local city council and say that you want to know whether or not your police department is participating, whether or not they have a policy, whether written or unwritten, about holding people for immigration. And you can confront your own local officials to ask them to stop participating in these forms of immigration roundups.
That's right. And that's how, you know, many of these sanctuary city initiatives have come about, is exactly by doing that local advocacy. So that's absolutely right. And, you know, many police departments across the United States, of their own volition, have told ICE, we're not going to do this for you. Mm-hmm. You're not paying us to do this. You can't force us to do this. And we believe that this is making our communities less safe. Because what happens when, you know, people who are immigrants who have something to fear in terms of immigration enforcement are afraid to go to the police and report crimes? That affects all of us. And we need to think about the effects that something like this has.
Right. There is ample proof of that in Maricopa County. If you look at Joe Arpaio's area, where he was focusing on profiling people of color, there was an increase in crimes against children, sex crimes against children that went uninvestigated by that sheriff's department because of his focus on profiling undocumented people.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there's been lots of reports of women that have been, you know, physically abused, or they or their children are under the threat of someone who is a U.S. citizen, but they can't report it because they're undocumented.
Right.
So
right.
We continue to put people that are the most vulnerable at risk when we do not give them protection as they are without status in this country. I want folks to know that your organization, Community Initiative for Visiting Migrants, which is going to change to, what did you say it's going to change to? Freedom?
Freedom for Immigrants.
Freedom for Immigrants. And does that have anything to do with the fact that CCA or Correctional, what is it called?
Yes, Correction Corporation of America.
Is changing their name, or has changed their name, correct?
That's right, yeah. So, our decision to change our name was influenced by the fact that Correction Corporation of America changed their name to Core Civic, and, you know, our organization is widely known as Civic.
Civic.
We feel that that's confusingly similar, and there, you know, are many people who we work with who are detained in Core Civic facilities, and there's been confusion about whether whether we, the organization that is providing support to them, are actually the private prison corporation that is imprisoning them. So, you know, we don't want to see that confusion anymore, and we want to be really clear that we are not CCA CoreCivic.
Right, and I thought it was incredible that CCA, who I believe has changed their name before, if I'm not mistaken, would not know who Civic is, would not know about your organization and your work, and that would choose a name so similar to yours. I wondered if that was purposeful in some ways to confuse people. But I'm glad that you're changing your name.
I can't speak to that, but we were really surprised as well.
So Freedom for Immigrants is what it's going to be, and you have a hotline where people can call. Can you talk about the hotline and how folks can get that information from you?
Yeah, so I would just encourage folks to, all of our contact information of our staff is on our website, which right now is endisolation.org, but that's going to change to freedomforimmigrants.org at some point next week. But we have all of our staff contact information listed, and we can, you know, explain more about this to anybody who's interested. Basically, it's a hotline for folks who are in immigration detention and who need to speak with our volunteers about any issues that they're suffering. And this basically, it allows them to make a free phone call to us.
And if somebody wants to start a visitation for immigrants program in their own community, can you help them begin that process and give them access
absolutely.
To resources?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge part of our work, is trying to help build the capacity of community groups that want to start these programs. And we have, you know, like I said, a network of over 43 individual programs, and we're constantly facilitating communication between all those programs and really providing opportunities to learn from what all of us are doing and how to support a wider movement to have this work of being engaged in actually being in these facilities and engaged in working with the people who are detained, how we can translate that into a movement to end the system.
And I just want for people to have your contact information. Civic is a 501c3 nonprofit California corporation recognized by the IRS as tax exempt. They can be reached at P.O. Box 40677, San Francisco, California, 94140. You can email them at info@endisolation.org. And that, of course, is going to be changing into freedomformigrants.org in the future here.
Oh, Freedom for Immigrants. Sorry.
Sorry. Yeah, Freedom for Immigrants.
Slightly different.
Freedomforimmigrants.org. And the number there is 385-212-4842. That's 385-21-CIVIC. I wanted to ask you about the quotas that are part of the contracts in these detention facilities, because that has a lot to do with the numbers of people that are detained in these facilities, does it not?
Absolutely, yes.
Could you speak to how those work? Because I think that most people think that the detention of a person is based upon whether or not they committed a crime or are a danger to society, when in fact, many of these contracts require for beds to be filled at a certain capacity within these facilities.
That's right. Yes. This is another huge problem that there is very little awareness around. So that's right. And this, the quotas, generally are affiliated with the private prison corporations. So generally in many of those contracts, ICE is saying, we promise you that we will make sure that this many beds in your facility are filled every single day. And what that is a reflection of is that there's a larger quota that has been mandated by Congress that has been interpreted to mean that we have to detain a minimum of 33,000 people every single day. But basically, these two things are linked. Basically, the national quota is a way to ensure that these local quotas that have been promised will be filled. And so what's driving immigration enforcement is not danger or criminality or need. It's actually this profit incentive, and it's the ability of these huge corporations to use their wealth to lobby our state and local and federal governments to continue to pass anti-immigrant legislation that will ensure them a steady stream of profit, which is human beings in cages in prisons.
And I really want to emphasize that, because what we have heard specifically in the State of the Union address recently with President Donald Trump is a conflagration with crime and immigrants, a comparison of the criminality of gang members of the MS-13 to regular everyday immigrants that are here in this country, in, you know, millions and millions of people that have been here, most of them over a decade of their lives. So I think that it's very important for people to understand that this is a business, that there's an incentive to keep people detained, to make sure that people are detained longer. We've had a zero net migration from south of the border in Mexico for at least the last 5 years, but detentions continue to increase while the number of deportees is actually not increasing. So where those people are going somewhere, they're being filled into these detention centers. And many of those people are families. They're women, they're children, and they're people that are mentally disabled as well. Can you speak to some of the abuses that are encountered by families in the system? I don't think that most people realize that people that are detained with their children are having their children put into detention centers. Some of these children are U.S. citizens. And that, in fact, there is an even more disturbing trend occurring more recently, where the children are being separated from their parents and put into the system.
This is very concerning. So you're absolutely right that in two facilities in the United States, one in Texas and one in Pennsylvania, families are detained. And basically how ICE is categorizing families is really women and children. So it's mothers and children who are detained together in these particular facilities. The conditions are really terrible. No matter what attempts these corporations are going to make it seem like it's not a prison, we're imprisoning children. There's no doubt about that. And there's no doubt about the effect that's having on these young people. There's also, like you said, now this trend to separate families at the border. This is as concerning as is family detention. What happens when families are separated is that children go into a system that is operated by a separate agency, the Office for Refugee Resettlement, and then their parents are being put into adult immigration detention centers. And what that means is a number of things. First of all, it means that the family is separated. Second of all, it means that the children and the parents are going to have separate legal cases. And this is really unfortunate because, you know, the ability of families to remain in the same sort of legal case structure is often really important. And then thirdly, because parents are detained, they're often going to lose custody of their children. And in many cases, children are going into the foster care system or being adopted, and these parents are losing their familial rights altogether.
Yeah, that's just heartbreaking to me. It feels like the poorest people that have the most difficulty within the system, children, people that have mental disabilities, or people that have no access to the English language whatsoever, are being squeezed. I mean, they're kind of being priced out of justice because they're having to get an attorney in many cases to represent them, which are incredibly expensive. And then they also right. many times have to pay exorbitant bonds in order to be released or have some family
That's
members
right.
released on bond while they're awaiting their hearing, which could take years and years. Most people don't understand that there's a very limited number of judges that hear these types of cases, and there is a backlog of hundreds of thousands of cases. Am I correct on this?
Yes. Yeah, I believe that's the case. I don't actually know the number off the top of my head, but yeah, the courts are backlogged as much as like 8 years for the non-detained docket. And then, you know, also extremely backlogged in the detained docket, which means people who are in detention. But yeah, I'm glad you brought up the legal representation. We haven't talked about that. One thing that's very important for people to know is that people in immigration detention are not afforded a court-appointed attorney if they can't afford one. So what that means is that 85% of people in this system are representing themselves in very complicated legal proceedings that they don't understand. Immigration law is more complicated than tax law. So it's extremely difficult for a lay person to grasp this law, never mind someone who may speak a different language. So people's chances of winning their cases are low in that sense. And if they are going to have a chance at winning their cases, they need to have access to community support. They need to have access to reasonably priced telephone calls. And in many cases, these things aren't provided because they have to, you know, gather documentation to support their cases. And in many cases, they just can't. And then they end up losing their cases, which is really unfortunate. And I also wanted to just, you know, you mentioned the sort of the folks who may be in immigration detention who may suffer from, you know, mental illness or other sorts of vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. That's definitely a huge problem in this system. And we've seen some really egregious cases. And I can sort of just like outline one for you and kind of the story that illustrates the importance mm-hmm. of our visitation programs. So we have an affiliated visitation program at a county jail facility in Etowah County. And actually, just this week, the sheriff of this facility, it turns out, basically, he has pocketed into his personal bank account $750,000 in jail food funds that were not allocated to feed the people in the facility. And he used $740,000 of that money to buy a beach home. And this is actually legal in Alabama, believe it or not. But we've been hearing from people detained by ICE at this facility for years that they're starving and that proper food is not, you know, provided to them. And this is the reason why.
So and now you know why.
Context. What's that?
And now we know why.
Yeah, now we know why. So at this facility, our visitation program is actually, the volunteers are not able to go into the facility in person. They go to an auxiliary building right next to where people are detained, and they have to visit with them through video. And this is an increasing trend to make people in jails and prisons all over the country even more isolated than they already are by setting up these video visitation services. So basically, one of our volunteers is visiting with a man over video, and suddenly this other man appears in the background of the video in, you know, behind the other man in detention, and he is very, you know, alarmed. He's stressed out about something, and it becomes clear to the volunteer that he can't speak English and that he's trying to communicate regardless of that. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he holds up a phone number against the screen, and he's just pointing at the phone number over and over again. And so the volunteer understands he wants me to call this phone number. So she does that. And then she finds out from this man's family that he is detained, but that he has like severe brain trauma from a car accident that happened back in 2008, and that every day he's waking up in detention and can't remember what he's doing there because is so damaged. And so we had to advocate along with this man's attorney for months that he be released from this system. And had we not known or had the access to know that this man was there, I'm not sure that we would have been able to help him.
I am so grateful for your work. I want to thank you for everything that you've done, as well as for giving us an example of hope, of what we can do to fight against this. One of the things on your vision statement that's very striking to me, it talks about your work, and it says, Civic envisions a world without isolation, because we believe isolation is the key component to oppression. Throughout history, the voices of those who've been colonized, exploited, and marginalized are rarely heard because those who are in power develop systems of isolation. These systems have taken many forms, such as Nazi concentration camps, Japanese internment camps, South African apartheid, and Jim Crow segregation laws. But we must not make this mistake and assume that this is merely history. Structures of isolation, oppression, and racism are alive today as they were 100 years ago. The current U.S. immigration detention system is designed to isolate us from one another in an effort to keep this system a secret from the American public and prevent widespread organizing against it. Well, I couldn't agree more with what you said there. It's so strong and so clear to me that this is a system of isolation, and it keeps us from seeing what's happening to some of the most exploitable people because they don't have a status in this country. And as I look at what has been happening, your program and the work that you're doing gives me hope. Do you see some of the things happening with ICE, like the recent the recent person that quit immigration, as a crack? Is this immigration, is Homeland Security cracking? Are they going to maybe ratchet back these draconian policies, these inhumane policies? I'd like to think their days are counted.
I would like to think their days are counted too. I do believe that we're seeing cracks in their infrastructure. But you know, their infrastructure is very, very strong, and Congress continues to fund it. And so we really need to make sure that Congress is not funding the abuse that's occurring in this system. And I think you're exactly right. Our volunteers, are dangerous to this system because they're meeting people in immigration detention that they become close to and form relationships with. We have countless volunteers who are now hosting a person who they met in detention who's seeking asylum, who needed a place to stay in order to be released from immigration detention. And so what we see in our network is that if given the chance, communities in this country want to be engaged in helping people who are coming to our country and who end up in immigration detention. And that's extremely dangerous.
Yes, yes. And I'm so glad that you guys are doing this work. If you want to participate, if you want to get some resources or bring a program like this to your community, you can get a hold of the Community Initiative for Visiting Migrants, which will be changing to Freedom for Immigrants, correct?
Yes.
Freedom for Immigrants. I want to make sure people know where to find you coming up as you change your name. And I want to make sure that people have a way of getting a hold of you if they want to volunteer or start something in their own area. You can get a hold of Civic by going to info@endisolation.org. You can email them there, or you can call them at 385-212-4842. That's 385-212-4842. I want to thank you once again so much for everything you do. This is Christina Mansfield from Civic, co-executive director of this initiative to visit migrants. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope that we can collaborate on some more work in the future and share the stories of the people that are working with you and the people that are in those detention centers here on 88.1.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
I'm glad that you had
Thank you so much.
I'm back, everybody. You know, one of the things that I thought was the coolest about that interview was that people that got involved in the visitation have ended up sponsoring people mm-hmm. so that they can get out. There are thousands and thousands, probably tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that are in detention centers that are eligible to be out on bond while they're awaiting their hearing. That could take many, many years. And as many of you know, the Supreme Court has recently ruled that holding people in detention indefinitely is not unconstitutional. Mm. So what that means is that these folks could be languishing in these for-profit prisons for as many years as those people want to keep them.
Exactly.
And the only way at this point which those people have any way of getting out is by being sponsored by somebody like you. You could get involved with a group like this and then become a sponsor. All you would have to do, and in many cases, these people, their families or people that are back home where they came from have gotten the money together. Sometimes people in the community get the money together for the bond. The thing is, they have nowhere to go. They have mm-hmm. to be staying at a U.S. citizen's home and give that address out. So if you've ever asked yourself the question, would you take in one of these undocumented people? And ask yourself that question in the context of knowing that the alternative is they're going to be slaves in one of these for-profit prisons in which they are exposed to being raped, treated poorly, not having their medical care taken care of, and all sorts of other abuses. And instead, they could be in your home. They could be free, mm-hmm. awaiting their hearing. That's something that I hope that a lot of people consider. And try and sponsor someone, get involved. If you can't do that, you can also participate in a pen pal program they have so you can write people in the jails and find out how they're doing. You become the eyes and ears for that particular individual in that particular facility. And you could be part of a movement to stop these detention centers from expanding, to stop them from abusing people on the inside. So I hope that people really do consider this as a resource and an opportunity. Next time, I will be bringing you more on immigration, and I'm going to be focusing on the sexual proclivities of the Europeans that came here and why that's still relevant to what's happening to immigration policy and immigrants in detention centers to this day. Thanks for being here on A Mexican Crossing Lines with Cindy Gomez-Shemp.
And Duke Gomez-Shemp.
You're listening to 88.1 FM, KPPPLP Fargo-Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. Good night.